And I guess you would be allowed to have this opportunity to have this sort of thought process because you're not working a normal job or fixed into any television programming schedules that might keep you more on track?
Well, I think that that's... I don't think that that's as relevant as you might think, actually. Because I think... society itself is conspiring to keep us fragmented. So, and certainly to the paranoid mindset, that's certainly not enough of a reassurance of like, oh, I'm in a temporal structure, therefore I can keep tabs of where I'm at when I'm there, kind of thing. If you were working your job and you went off and did a mission and then came back, somebody would notice, but then you might be able to square it with that somebody so that they don't mention it. So then how would you know that you hadn't squared it? Or then the screen memories, you might remember watching a TV show, but in fact, when it was there, but in fact you never saw it. Like, how do we know? Like, it's only when we analyze the contents of our conscious mind that we can determine whether they're consistent or not. But if we don't, like, if there are errors that are inconsistent, we would actually unconsciously know to stay away from them. I mean, this is what I'm finding out. I feel like we're getting a bit off, way off course in a sense, but maybe because it's difficult for you to relate to my experience. But this is what I'm finding out about my own past, is that there's a whole section of it that's hidden from me, and that somehow that corresponds with the present too. There's a whole portion of me that's hidden from me. And to bring it back to the original point about stoicism and one's own actions and virtue, I wonder if the Stoics factored this in, that becoming whole, which is to become autonomous, which is to have that kind of option of actually being virtuous, let's say, or of being responsible for one's actions, that, as I'm experiencing, entails recognizing the ways in which we are absolutely the adverse of what we would consider virtue, what we would hope to be. And that, that's the shadow, to use a Jungian term. That to have an identity at all that can talk about virtue at all means disowning everything that doesn't come under the rubric of virtue. And then those fragments become autonomous. And so you've got Jekyll and Hyde, right?
Aren't you sort of making the assumption that you can't work from, you can't operate from a stance of virtue while recognizing that might not actually be your only grounding?
I didn't understand that question.
You're saying by thinking that you're operating from that you're operating virtuously, or that it's your intent to be virtuous, You are necessarily ignoring parts of yourself that aren't virtuous, right?
Well, not just that, but that desire to be virtuous itself will cause us to banish all aspects of us that aren't virtuous into the unconscious. So we won't become more virtuous, we'll just become more fragmented. More controlling also.
I don't know if that's necessary.
Where does this idea of virtue come from? I mean, like, I guess that's the question, isn't it? It's like, what does virtue consist of?
Well, I can tie this back around to where our conversation began. I think the virtue is seeking that homeostasis or that harmony. I was talking about trying to ride when I was working with other people energetically. So virtue is working towards a state of wholeness within the thing itself. The Stoics refer to nature as fuchsia, and fuchsia is a thing's true potential inside of itself, which it's always working to develop towards if it's virtuous. Right.
If it's virtuous.
Right.
Or what if it's not? I mean, why would anything not work towards its full potential? Anything in nature.
Yeah, I think that's part of the trick, is that it is sort of inevitable to be virtuous.
Yeah. In the sense of being whole.
Right. Eventually. Yeah.
Eventually. Right, so... So I suppose all I'm getting at, and I don't feel it's particularly new to me to say this, but is that the the drive to wholeness it kind of reinforces the lack of it, the lack of wholeness. Because I suppose it's maybe it relates to the being and doing dichotomy, which is very fundamental, and that at a level of being, I'm not sure we can be anything besides whole. So then, if you want to make a doing out of it, it seems like that's a split in itself, like the split between being and doing. Well, that sounds a bit fanciful, but I'm just trying to express something succinctly for a change.
So what sort of changes, if anything, would you like to see happen? Or are we just engaging in your own efforts to describe something that doesn't need to be described, perhaps? So.
I think, you and I are not attempting, we're having a dialogue, but we're attempting to, I suppose, make our experience of each other as whole as it can be. So that to some extent requires a meeting or an agreement, so that you can get my scent, I can get your scent, we can smell each other's butts and say, okay, I know where he's, you know, what he's had for dinner, and I can run with this hound, whatever. I don't really identify as a dog, but anyway, started with that metaphor. That we can run together, we can feel safe together, so that some transmission can happen in the deepest or the purest sense. That would be my attempt to put in words, you know, why we have this conversation at all. It's because I don't think we're trying to bash out the world's problems or even our own problems. I don't want to change. Like, talking to you now, the only thing I want to change is that. Is I want to get to as deep or as real a place in our conversation as I can get, so that we can both be enriched by it. And that thing about surfing, that's true also of a conversation, isn't it?
Yeah.
That there's an energy and there's a flow, and we're not necessarily trying, but there's an opportunity to really get carried by that, to get transported by it. So, you know, this conversation began in quite an unusual way for me, I think, which is that you presented me with an unfamiliar testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, this guy can smell, he's just been in the bathroom. He must be really embodied. And maybe you are, maybe you're not. I mean, I've just met you, and I've, you know, done a lot of speculation and analysis about how special abilities can relate to disembodiment, but my sense of view isn't that it's that kind of psychic superpower, but it's just something that somehow you've managed not to lose, that we all have. That's my sense. And then you talked about how you read a lot of occult stuff and how that had reinforced some of your experiences.
Well, I wouldn't misrepresent myself as saying I'm heavy into occult study. I would say I skim in depth, but I do not delve necessarily into anything particularly.
So what does it do for you? I mean, well, you've already said that it validates and strengthens certain experiences, yeah. But can you, I don't know, is there anything else to add or anything more specific there?
I guess the best way I can think to describe it right now is that mundane reality just seems so untrue that...
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. No, that's good, because I think that's the crux. I mean, if there was some, I wouldn't even call it tension, but some lack of agreement between us that resulted in a sort of estrangement of threads or whatever the hell was going on there, then I think that is the crux of it, is that, well, this isn't the crux, but relating to the crux, you're 23, I'm 49. When I was 23, and I certainly wasn't anywhere near as grounded as you sound, I was just at the beginning of a path that I thought and hoped and fully, fiercely intended was going to get bigger and more cosmic and more transcendental with every passing year. And the mundane of my existence, which was actually quite small because I inherited a fortune, I could do whatever the hell I wanted. But anyway, that was something that was just, you know, I wouldn't see it for the dust. I was just going to blast, you know, every last mundane element of my existence to smithereens, and until all that was left was a shining bright sphere of super transcendental shamanic consciousness, whatever it was, you know, however I was going to do that. Now, I don't get that impression of you that you're on some kind of wild ego inflated mission like I see myself as back then, but in contrast anyway to that now, I would say that the sweetness of living and the real value of living is in the mundane and not in the transcendental, and maybe that's transcendence, right? I mean, I'm not gonna say that, I mean, I'm not gonna pretend that I'm just a thrift store owner and that's it. There's a wonder in existence for sure, and it's unfathomable to me. But there's less and less of a difference between what you're calling the mundane and whatever you would juxtapose that with, right?
Well, we probably have different associations around, like, the word mundane.
I don't know. We'd have different experiences, yeah. But I mean, I think it's more than, for you, what you're talking about is more than just, there's more at stake, because you, than there was for me in particular terms of the mundane, because I never had to work a day job, much less a day job that was, you know, seriously affecting my nervous system and the things that you've described. And it sounds as though from that your obligation to engage with the mundane world, that is to some extent at least experienced as a threat on your very being.
Sure.
Which I wouldn't argue with. I mean, that is the world we live in. But what I would question is that there's anything wrong with that, like that's any different from the equivalent of any organism that has to survive. I'm not saying you shouldn't quit the job, by the way, or anything like that, but just that those adverse conditions, although the danger is that they will sabotage us to the point that we'll be essentially destroyed by them. I mean, most people on this planet are casualties of trauma, in my opinion, and that's terrible. I mean, it's a horrendous reality, but it's not the only option, and B, there isn't there isn't any way to evade those adversarial circumstances anyway. I mean, the spiritual path, as I discovered in the most viscerally horrific way last night, is not away from those conditions. It's all the way into them.
Yeah, maybe part of my thinking is skewed by a sense of morality. That's something that's been in my thinking for years now, just ethics in general. But when what I associate with the mundane is, I guess, acts of violence, things that happen all the time in our everyday lives. Just, you know, the fact that our labor, our energy goes to power this system that we were born into without our consent. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I know you have some issues with the idea of consent, but so yeah, I think my aversion to the mundane was in order to find knowledge. I guess that goes back to Garden of Eden. If me looking for knowledge of good and evil is what's separating me or causing suffering.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, it sounds like it, doesn't it? And it does seem to speak to something that I'm wrestling with myself in my own path of knowledge, is that the quest for knowledge seems to be one with the will to power, more recently termed the pursuit of happiness, and that all of these drives are sourced in original trauma, original acts of violence that shattered our sense of physical peace or physical harmony so severely that A, we would do anything to try and escape that discomfort and distress, and B, we would be completely incapacitated in terms of resolving it.
You say you don't like the word transcendent, but what? How would you describe what you're talking about now? Relating individual experiences to some larger whole we're unconscious of.
Well, it's more imminent, though, isn't it? I mean, it's almost the opposite, because trauma is imminent within us. It's like it's embedded in our nervous systems. So it may seem transcendent in the sense that our own identity selves are dwarfed by it and powerless in the face of it. And so then there's this corresponding urge to want to transcend it in some way, rise above it. But it's the opposite of transcendent, because it's that reality that's bigger than us is embedded in ourselves. So it's, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm not sure, is this answering your question? Because it wasn't clear to me exactly how you understood what I said and how you understand transcendent.
Mm. I guess you were talking about fragments in our own psyche, maybe being related to some experience that's actually outside of what we would consider ourselves.
You mean someone else? Something being done to us?
Right, so you're speaking to an event in the past, or more outside of time? I guess that's what I was wondering.
Oh, no, yeah, not nothing.
Or you're talking about an experience.
Nothing cosmic. I mean, I think the Garden of Eden, the original trauma, is true in terms of consciousness, but I don't think we need to go there today or generally, but in terms of each of us in our individual bodies having suffered some kind of massive impact, traumatic impact, to one degree or another.
Mm. Are you just speaking of general trauma someone might receive? Like circumcision or something?
Well, yeah, to use a very apropos example, yeah. and so, an example of something that's considered, oh, well, what's the big deal? They don't remember it anyway, but I would say could very easily destroy a person's chance at wholeness for their entire life.
Mm.
Were you circumcised?
I was not.
Yeah. Well, you dodged that bullet then, as did I.
Yeah.
But there are many other bullets.
Many other bullets.
Yeah.
Mm.
At bay the night, and it keeps away the beast. But why'd you keep away the beast? Why are you afraid of the beast? And let's not argue pedantics about who is gonna win, 'cause I'm not entering your races, so I don't think that's relevant. And all I need's a patch of sunlight from which to watch the world run by. You tell me life, it is a rat race. Well, I'm the rat, so I've got time. Yes, I'm the rat, so I've got time. This cat's got time. This cat's got time. This cat's got time. Cat's got time.
So, I mean, the notion of virtue and the notion of wholeness, I have termed, well, I do use the term wholeness, embodiment. I mean, that's how I use the term embodiment. And I think embodiment relates to autonomy, like autonomy is only possible if we're embodied. And what prevents embodiment? Trauma and dissociation, mentalization, future orientation, the quest, the drive for power and knowledge that can become power, and so on. Like, it's like we've touched on many of the points that do intersect in some fundamental way in my experience. And maybe I've been talking to you, I wouldn't say above your head or anything, but this hasn't hit the target of where you're at.
Right.
Because of that, the testimony you made and because of my sense of you, I mean, my sense of you is as somebody who is aware of things at a much deeper level than mentally. It doesn't really need knowledge to such a great extent. I mean, unless you're going to call somebody sent, being able to decode somebody's sent knowledge, see, I wouldn't quite call that knowledge. That's like an innate capacity of the organism.
Mm.
Like you can't get that out of a book, or even from a wise man on a mountaintop. It's in the body.
So why do you think we're trying to disembody ourselves? Or that is what you... This is what you think, right? Or do you think it's some outside?
Yeah, no, I think it's a good way to put it. I mean, it's better than... I avoid saying that, you know, they are trying to disembody us, mm-hmm. or you know, having a subject to that description, because although I think that there are groups behind it, they themselves are disembodied and so on. And so the original cause would seem to be inside of us. Yeah. So what was the question? Why?
Yeah. Well, you say society fragments itself.
Yeah, well, I don't know if there's an answer, because I think that it's one of those chicken or an egg things, because if I were to say the simple answer would be pain relief, then that still leaves the question of, well, why are we seeking pain relief? And the answer being that we're in pain on the one hand, so then why are we in pain? And the other answer being that we can't accept being in pain, so then you have the question, well, why can't, you know what I mean? It's like, I think it's unknowable. One can map it back to fairly far in terms of like social goals. What are the social goals? But then that's still in the us and them framework.
So I, from what I understand, you've embraced uncertainty to some extent. But are there any schools of thought you relate to?
That's an interesting double-pronged statement question. Have I embraced uncertainty? Well, I would want to ask myself, first of all, because that is liminalism, supposedly, but I'm aware of how I'm not as liminalist as perhaps I could be, or as uncertain. So, and then you related it to how I seem to reject schools of thought and all the rest of it, which is very true. What was the question again?
Are there any schools of thought that you relate to?
Oh, that idea. Well, yeah, there is. I mean, there's the psychological Freudian Jungian one. I'm unfortunately or lamentably dependent on it, I would say.
Yeah, I'm not very familiar with the work of Freud. But I've read some Jung and really relate to his ideas. So I'm wondering if I understand enough to see where you're at, where you're coming from.
Well, it shouldn't depend on Jung. I mean, I have used and might use terms that I got from Jung, and obviously the psyche is... whoever that came from, I think it must have predated Freud. It's a Greek term anyway. But in terms of relating to where I'm coming from, I would say that, I mean, unfortunately you can't go to the bathroom after I've been there, because I would say it's less to do with, you know, the constructions of knowledge and belief and that I might rely on than actually my experience, whatever you would call that. I mean, what is it that you pick up when you smell somebody's scent? You know what they had for dinner or lunch, but there's a lot more to it, presumably. Like, that would just be the tip of the iceberg, wouldn't it?
Right.
So you're getting a sense of somebody's state of embodiment, let's say.
Yeah. So that's not really any sort of foundation. Does that include some philosophical foundation, having a psychological worldview?
I think psychology is the evolution of philosophy. Like, what was once philosophy became psychology is pretty much my view about that. Like, it was the same discipline that evolved. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, perhaps.
Because your predilection is for philosophy.
It's one mode I engage in.
Yeah. Do you know Diogenes?
It's familiar, no. I can't recollect. Well,
I was thinking he was the original Stoic, but I think he was more the original Skeptic. But aren't the Stoics and Skeptics kind of closely related?
I'm not well read enough to really speak on that.
Oh.
But I would say that there's a very religious nature to Stoic thinking, so I have a hard time thinking that they're related, really. Skepticism and Stoicism.
I could be completely off about that. So let's because it seems like you're sort of couldn't think of the word, but sort of groping around for something. And because we've been on for almost 2 hours, so I guess we'll need to wind up fairly soon. What did you or would you hope to get from having this conversation? Like, is there something you want to go into or get into or bring out of it?
I don't think there's anything I'm really trying to get out of it. I guess I would glean from you whatever I can, and if I can offer anything, I would, you know, like to do that. I guess I thought that I might relay some of my more mystical experiences with you, but I don't know if that's really necessary or if it would bear any fruit. I guess I would hope that it might be able to give me a better sense of stability. Because, like I said, there are a lot of things I can't talk about in my normal group of friends.
Right. So, and do you feel, like, less inclined to do so than when we started this conversation?
No.
All right, well, as long as they're not too long and, involved stories, then let me have one or two. I mean, I'd be happy to hear them.
Sure. Well, when I was around 15, 16 years old, I started experimenting with psychedelics, I would always have bad experiences until after I graduated high school. I went on a road trip around the country with my girlfriend at the time. And I learned some meditation techniques, mostly practicing transcendental meditation. And that led me to a mushroom experience where I was talking to my friend and I started to have a bad trip. And I went into my breathing technique and I closed my eyes and saw a sort of astral outline of a rectangular object floating in my vision. And I opened up my eyes and my friend threw a piece of paper and I saw the exact same impression. So that was a premonition experience I had on mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
I did have a much more substantial premonition on salvia. I won't go into all the details of the trip, but the first time I did it, my girlfriend and I were in California, where it's legal, and I got caught into a loop of a vision of a friend of mine getting down on his hands and knees like I was on the ground myself, and saying something to me, and that just started looping into what seemed like eternity. And then 2 months later, I had completely forgotten about experiencing the loop the first time and actually tripped with that same friend, and we did the salvia together, and I ended up positioning myself where I was on the ground and he got down and said something to me, and that same loop started into infinity again.
Was that an unpleasant experience?
Yes.
Right, is that an understatement?
No, it wasn't like a torturous hell or anything. It's just being completely lost, I guess.
Well, perhaps not completely. Because I would think that that would be a torturous hell.
Yeah.
If one was completely lost. So, what is it about those experiences that preoccupies you?
Well, it's probably most important one of my an important psychedelic experience that happened to me that I'm probably still dealing with and have some PTSD around. It was an ayahuasca experience. I ordered some myself and prepared it with a friend of mine. And so I took about half of my brew and I was just in a dreamy, light sort of state, and we were doing this in the daytime so it wouldn't get too heavy as an introductory sort of experience. And then I woke up from that dreamlike state around sunset and I took the rest of my half of brew and I took the rest of my friend's brew who said that he was done. And I started cackling for like 20 minutes hysterically and fell into complete blackness. And once I was in that state of nothingness besides my own awareness, the only way I can describe it is sort of like I vaguely could still remember that I had a body, and I was constantly trying to sit up in bed, and the sort of gush of maybe emotional experience would happen, and then I would lie down and go back to sleep, and that would just keep happening of me sitting up, experiencing things, and then lying down, like going to sleep.
And where were you when you were lying down and not asleep? I mean, what was your perceptual experience of?
During the ayahuasca experience?
Well, yeah, because you said that you had to get back to your body, essentially, and so then you...
Yeah.
Sounds like you were going in and out of your body, kind of.
Right, yeah, I think that probably was what was happening, because eventually, after eternity, that was hell. I was finally...
Well, why was it hellish, though? You haven't described why it was actually hellish.
Well, I guess in the salvia experience, I was at least experiencing a loop of something familiar, like my friend getting down and saying something to me. But in the ayahuasca experience, it was complete darkness.
So there wasn't actually nothing happening perceptually?
No, I was still having perceptions. It wasn't absolutely nothing. I mean, I was experiencing fear.
Right, well, was that a perceptual experience?
Right.
Or was that it was perceptual? As opposed to emotional?
Yes. I'm not really sure.
So you don't remember any sensory impressions during those periods of darkness?
That was, I think it was emotional and perceptual. So it was complete darkness, but maybe the impression of myself trying to sit up, and then it was still darkness, but it was as if I was having a lot of sensory experiences, but they weren't significant. It was just dust in the wind. But eventually I was able to make it onto my knees in this nothingness, substanceless impression of myself, and I didn't consider myself an atheist or theist at the time, but I because of the experience, I got on my knees and prayed to God, please put me down. And eventually my room started fading back into view piece by piece, actually like object by object. And then once my room had finally reappeared, an old friend who I hadn't seen in a long time was at my door. And then I opened the door and let him in, and then a flood of old friends that I hadn't seen in a long time came into my room right after this ayahuasca experience.
Was that pleasant?
It wasn't overly pleasant.
But it wasn't unpleasant.
Right. It was comforting, I guess, because I was becoming cognizant again towards the end of the experience, and I was starting to wonder if I had created the friend who I drank the brew with just to have this experience, and I was having sorts of delusional thoughts like I created reality, obviously, mm-hmm. because I was experiencing the state of nothingness, so.
And have you done psychedelics since then?
Yes, I have. I didn't do. I haven't done ayahuasca again. I've done mushrooms and LSD since then.
It sounds like you've done quite a fair bit then.
I'm experienced. Yes.
Maybe even more than I'd done at 23. Although I'd done, I guess I started in earnest at the age of 23, I think.
Mm.
And you will you continue to do, like, it's part of your life, would you say, the psychedelic experience?
No. I mean, I do relate to it, and I think I explore its potentials for use in cognition and stuff. Like I said, I'm interested in sort of optimizing human functioning through diet and whatever other means, so I'm interested in it in that way. But I don't look at it as any sort of magical alternate reality or anything like that.
And how about as a way to transcend the mundane?
That gets really difficult, I think, because people have preconceptions about what the mundane world really is. It's like if you're eating magic mushrooms, you're not experiencing the mundane world. Well, I would argue that maybe that psychedelic substance might have been an essential nutrient at some point in our evolution. So I don't think I'm actually taking myself out of what might be called the mundane world by taking a psychedelic.
You wouldn't say that that was part of your motivation then, consciously or otherwise, because you did express a desire to escape the mundane.
Well, I acknowledge that I'm trying to experience something different, but I guess I'd argue that it's not necessarily escaping the mundane if it's a normal human experience to have that's maybe, you know, something that's missing in our society.
Well, I don't know, it sounds like you're trying to have it both ways now.
I like it that way. I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, because you did specifically say that you recognize in yourself a desire to escape the mundane. And,
right, but I would also argue that the mundane is too mundane, that that's not the actual threshold of...
Well, I mean, what about the possibility that you did escape the mundane and that's it? That's the only thing there is outside the mundane, is nothingness.
Yeah. I think that that probably was perhaps unconsciously a big part of what led me to where I am now, you know, hanging out with logically minded philosophers and
You mean as a tonic for those kind of mind-shattering experiences?
Well, no, I think I've just tried to ground myself and regardless if there is something to be transcended or to transcend to, rather, that I have given ultimate importance to this, whatever you call it, 3D experience, and that led me to where I am now. It's not really activism, but awareness and spreading awareness to whoever's in my life by natural circumstances. I don't try to put myself out there.
So why is this something that you wouldn't talk about with this current set that you're in?
I guess none of them like engaging in, I guess, liminal sort of discussions. Everything has to be well defined before you can even begin to entertain it. You know, you start off with your definitions, and that becomes difficult when you're talking about experiences that other people might not be able to relate to.
So, if they haven't done psychedelics, for example.
Yeah, and they actually have, but they just don't think about, they don't give, I don't know if we experience the same things.
Well, you wouldn't know if you hadn't talked about it.
I did bring it up, I have brought it up, but no, I never sense a connection with other people with my psychedelic experiences. A lot of the people in my friend group have done psychedelics, but we don't really relate to them. We hosted a festival over the summer, and we took LSD at this event, and during the experience, just looking around at people, they all seemed to still be in the regular everyday world. I don't know. And
So your reason for wanting to talk about this is that you don't necessarily just see it as perhaps your current friends would see it, as in you took a substance, the substance affected your neurology and you had a hallucination. You wonder if you experienced something closer to reality via those avenues.
Right. I definitely think some of the experiences are more true in some sense than everyday reality, but I don't have the delusion that, like, what I saw was real. It's almost like I was seeing better metaphors. I'm not sure.
So what would complete darkness be a metaphor for?
Never spoke a word, never told a lie. The little boy I knew didn't go to school. His old man swore nothing but a fool. I trust nobody but myself these days. I'm hiding in a shelter underground. Yeah, the voices in my head telling me I am a freak, I am a freak, I am a... The troubled man I knew never would fit in, stumbled all around. the city of sin. The troubled man I knew spent all his time in the underworld in the name of crime. I trust nobody but myself. These days I'm hiding in a shelter underground. Yeah, the voices in my head keep telling me I am a freak, I am a freak, I am a freak. One night or day I cannot tell. I woke up from my sleep. She was standing by my bed, her eyes dark and deep. Never got to know my mom, but in my heart I knew. The next minute she was gone, and I cried. Never spoke a word, never told a lie. Here's another clue, if you didn't see, little boy I know looks a bit like me.
You don't have to answer that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of those hanging questions.
Right.
And I've had my own experiences, and I've had at least one that came to mind when you were describing yours, in which words, as I'm sure you're aware in trying to recount your own experience, words don't even begin to cut it. So I guess I'll just have to try and describe mine. Obviously, I didn't want to spend too much time on this because I don't want this to be too long a podcast, but I had eaten some marijuana cookies that I'd made, and they were improbably strong, and I found myself, I had left the party at this point fortunately perhaps, and I found myself lying on a bed and unable to experience myself as being present. The sensory data was still there, but I wasn't able to translate it into something that actually meant anything, let's say. So I remember rubbing my hands together, and I could recognize that there was sensation. It wasn't like my fingers were numb, but I couldn't relate to or identify with the sensations in any way. So it was as if the senses were still perceiving, but there was that I was no longer there to perceive them in some way. But this wasn't, there wasn't a sense of liberation. It was the opposite of liberating. And then I had a visual impression of where, whatever state I was in, which emotionally was one of sheer horror, and that was of this black box, this black metal box, floating in infinite space. And I, you know, my mental self, let's call it that, you know, my self-reflective self was suspended in this black box, surrounded by infinite, eternal nothingness. I could say I panicked, but actually I didn't do anything particularly panicky. I mean, I got up, and I was lying there kind of gasping and making expressions of horror for a while, and then I got up and put my boots on. I was watching myself put the boots on and was completely unable to comprehend what I was doing and how I was able to do it. I won't tell the whole story, because although it's a fun story, it's not really relevant to the just a sharing that this experience. Well, I'll kind of sum it up, because I was in the small village in Spain, and I had this weird oral phenomenon where I heard the laugh of this brujo, this witch who was in the town, and he wasn't there. It was the middle of the night, but that led me to go to his house and wake him up, because I'd actually heard him laughing like he was right next to me. So I thought he was in on it in some way. Anyway, I woke him up, and he was completely bewildered what I was doing there, and I started telling him. I can't remember what I said, but it's like, I've gone crazy, I've gone completely crazy, I've gone insane, I've lost my... And as I was doing, he was just listening and nodding his head, and I think he was just kind of smiling. And I realized that I was behaving perfectly normally, even though I was saying the opposite. I'd put my boots on, I'd got over there, I was, you know... And so I felt suddenly kind of ridiculous. I'd woken him up in the middle of the night, I was making this big to-do, but I couldn't even describe what was going on, like why it was such a big deal. And he said, go back to the house, remember these plants that I brought over, they're on the kitchen table, make a tea out of them and drink them, and then you'll be fine. And so I thanked him, and I started walking back, and I, out on my way back, I looked up at the sky and the stars, and something just shifted, and I was still in this state of not being able to relate to my own existence, and not being able to fit myself into my mental construct of who I was or whatever it was, but it suddenly didn't matter. And the feeling of being absolutely damned and lost, and, you know, hurled into the outer abysses of nothingness, turned into a feeling of being completely free, like I had transcended something. And I felt this uplift of euphoria of like, what a feeling, I finally reached some state that I've been trying so hard to reach. And I went back in, and I saw the plants on the thing, and I just laughed, and I realized that the brujo had just said anything, basically. He'd known that, you know, what I was in was just a temporary thing, and so he'd just given me some task to do just to keep me occupied, and so I just went to bed. And anyway, that was the end of the story, and I woke up in the morning, and I was back to normal again. And I've had kind of equivalent experiences on several occasions. I would say each time, this was the first, and each time more intense, more horrific, more nightmarish. And I want to say they all come down to dot, 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 but I don't quite know what those dots are. I think it was the second one, but anyway, I was actually on a plane, and I just smoked marijuana, and... something happened as I was getting on the plane, and I lost my mind. I lost my mind, and I got on the plane, and I was just having these completely insane thoughts. I got on the plane, I looked, and I said, everyone on this plane is going to die. And I sat down at my seat, and all I could think was, I've lost my mind. And it was like each thought was isolate. You know how when we think, generally it's all the thoughts tie together, and that there's a constant stream, and that's the continuity of the self. And so we don't even experience ourselves as thinking, we experience ourselves as thought, really. You know, I am the thoughts that I'm thinking, kind of experience of self. And so that was all gone. So I was just this sensory apparatus perceiving my environment and in totally different ways, as if I was on an alien spaceship. And then I was hearing these single thoughts that would come. I've lost my mind, boom. And then again, I've lost my mind, boom. That was all I could think for a period, was just that one thought. And so on. Anyway, again, I won't tell the whole story, but I was in a state of horror, you know, sheer horror, and I was convinced that I would never get my mind back, I was going to be a vegetable. But again, I could still act. You know, I took my boots off. The woman in the seat next to me obviously noticed, thought that I was a first-time flyer or a flyer phobic or whatever, and she patted my knee and said, it's going to be fine. So I obviously was communicating some kind of panic, even though I wasn't actually, you know, screaming or thrashing or anything. Or maybe she was just very in tune. But anyway, so all of these experiences now they could be interpreted, as I did afterwards at that time, as transcendental experiences in which I transcended the ego's self and wasn't ready, premature enlightenment experiences. But they could also be experienced as something perhaps more mundane, and it's not either or, which I think was a term for it, annihilation anxiety, and it relates, I don't know, I haven't read the literature myself, but it relates to the infant years when the identity is still forming. And if we think about it, like bring it back to the embodiment thing, it requires a degree of filtering even to be able to interpret our the sensory data that we're receiving physically, never mind to turn it into a narrative, a first person narrative that is an identity. So annihilation anxiety, I think, relates to that liminal space where we have an identity, but it's not fully formed, and it can be overwhelmed so easily. And if we're overwhelmed and we lose the sense of identity and we can't navigate our environment, then we can die. So, and that's a bit later on, I think it, as an infant, it's more like we don't have to navigate our environment, but it's more like if we're not sufficiently embodied, if we're too immersed via the trauma in the mother's psyche, because that's where we come from, the body, mother, body, psyche, then we might actually physically die, because we won't be in our bodies. Like our bodies, like crib death, our bodies will just, you know, they'll lose heat, they'll lose energy, and we'll disconnect astrally or whatever, float off, and then the body will die, and then we're all at sea, or maybe we're already all at sea, I don't know, obviously I'm having to guess about what it must be like. But if there's something like that that occurs to us as infants, we would have a body memory of that, and more, I mean, maybe even more than body, if we are more than bodies. And so it's like, well, I don't know how much further I can go with this, but if that also relates to our failed embodiment, then as we're trying to individuate or trying to get to the truth, or however you want to call it, by taking psychedelics, we re-experience the very experiences that have caused us to feel so estranged and lost in the mundane to begin with, because we're trying to get back to and resolve something and make something happen that never happened, which was embodiment. So that's kind of my take on your experiences. I think they are mundane, actually. I think they're more mundane than you being able to smell who's been to the bathroom, in a sense. Although I'm not sure if mundane is the word. I mean, they're certainly less amazing to me. Like, those kind of stories and premonitions and all the rest, and I take them and leave them, really. Unless we ground them in something that is meaningful, as opposed to some speculative fantasy about how, oh, this is original consciousness and we're all God perceiving the world into being and la-di-da-di-da, which, although I think is true, personally, it's just so irrelevant, right? I mean, like, that's not something that we need to work through. That's just something, if it's true, then it's always been true, it always will be true, and there's nothing God ever has to do, which is perceiving. But it's not that, because it's not peaceful. It's not, there's an anxiety and a distress in it, right?
Definitely.
So then where's that come from? Well, anxiety and distress are bodily. They're bodily responses, so... So I think they're in the body. I think they're actually in the body. And I mean, I'm very I'm very distrustful of psychedelics at this point, and as far as I'm very skeptical about their uses, that they're having a positive use. Really, I mean, I think that I suppose to bring it back to a point I made very early on, like your perceptual capacities, you know, is that useful? It was a rhetorical question for me, really. I just wanted to hear the ways that you used it, because it's clear to me that that would be useful, to be able to know something about people by smelling them. But is the kind of knowledge that we might gain through psychedelics, is it useful? Can we apply it in our daily lives? Well, I found that I couldn't. I could only write books about it, which I don't see as inherently useful behavior, you know.
Yeah,
it's fun, but I don't think it's inherently useful. It could be survival based, but in my case it wasn't. Writing books, I mean. And the psychedelics, well, I had some incredible premonitions. I had a vision that my brother killed himself. Well, he didn't kill himself in the way that I visioned it, with a gun. He did it with a heroin needle, or was killed. But whatever, I did see it coming. I did actually receive a package of information from the future there, to some extent. But you could also interpret that in terms of the past, that I recognized the patterns of trauma in his psyche at a bodily level, and I knew that they would destroy him. So for me, the main thing I got from psychedelics was, I guess, an inflated idea of what I could know about myself and about existence. I felt like I'd seen the truth, and you know, maybe I did, but as you're describing, it's not something you can talk about in a grounded way. Anyway, you can only find other people who've gone off on that same tangent, that binge, and will go, yeah man, yeah, I saw the creation of the universe too, I was there too. it's not in the present kind of engagement, that kind of focus, I don't think, which is, again, it's back to the mundane being not mundane. It's, we live in an information rich universe. Psychedelics enhance our powers to receive information, for sure, but they don't enhance our power to process it, so most of it is unprocessable. So then we end up with these experiences too big to embody.
Right.
Which is like trauma. I think psychedelics is self-traumatizing.
I see, just creating more unconscious?
In a sense, but it's the opposite too, because we allow unconscious matter to come into consciousness. Where's those visions come from? They must come. They don't come from outside of us. So that must be stuff that's in us that we're unconscious of, just as when we dream. But then, where's it go? So it's. I think it does make us more unconscious, because that's the price of becoming much more unconscious in a way that is artificially induced. I'm aware that the term artificial is a moving one there, but it's self-induced, let's say. When the unconscious is smarter than we are, like the unconscious knows, it's more conscious than we are, that's the irony of that term. It knows what we're ready to see. That's why we have dreams. And so when we want to take psychedelics, it's an attempt to override our own psyches and say, no, I want more. And only the ego would do that. Like, the psyche itself doesn't need more. It's already the whole. So I think to a large extent we've been tricked by circumstances and other things to try and engineer our own awakenings, because that's the very thing that prevents awakening. Well, it's not probably the only thing, because we can, but it certainly, we become complicit with the forces that want to prevent our awakening. by trying to bring it about.
I would say I'll see you in the morning, but I know all the good will be gone. It is clear you sadly have to leave now, so I'll wave goodbye, good heart. When the night is slowly sleeping and we come to the final tune, I hold you close to me, darling, and I hope to see you soon.
So I don't know if that was helpful at all.
It's something to mull over.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps not what you were...
No, yeah, sorry.
hoping to hear.
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure if I have a good jumping point from that.
Oh, well, it's good that you don't, actually, because I think that we've probably said enough, and I know that we've got enough material that I want to work into a podcast. I don't like to limit a conversation to that in an overly forced way, but it's a good natural boundary.
Well, I'm not looking to you for advice necessarily, but I don't know if this is something you probably wouldn't want to use on the podcast, but I'm at a point in my life where I'm really not sure where I want to go. I mean, I have inclinations as to what I might do. Like, I enjoy biology and I enjoy nature, and I think I'd enjoy working with people or medicine or something like that. But money is a big issue, you know, just poverty. And I'm at a point where I just lost my job, so I'm really not sure where I want to go. I mean, I'm thinking about selling my car and all my possessions, and...
Oh, you mentioned that. Did you in an email? So you're liminal and thinking of becoming more so.
Right. Right, yeah, I'm just not really sure what is important for me to do.
So that's a good illustration of the usefulness of knowledge, like what kind of knowledge would be useful to you in the current situation. Like, can you find a scent and follow it? When you've lost the previous scent. And I think that, I know you're not asking advice, and I certainly try not to give it because I don't like experiencing myself as someone who gives advice. I mean, I don't believe in myself as that. But having said that, I think a really good working rule, and this is about liminality, in this metaphor of losing one scent and waiting for another, is emphasis on the waiting. As in, there's no need to act. There's no need to try and move forward if you don't have a scent to follow. I know you said money's an issue, so it feels like there's this pressure, but that's a trick, in my opinion. That's a trick that is done to us that we become complicit with. We believe in it, and then we keep tricking ourselves into thinking that there's something at stake and that the situation is urgent.
But yeah, I mean it gets sticky, I suppose, and I don't, you know, expect you to go into this with me. But yeah, there's a a lot of guilt associated with that, as far as being a burden on people I'm around who might end up having to support me, or, you know, people who want to support me.
There is always going to be. I mean, that's how we become complicit in the trick, is we believe the narratives, whatever they may be, that that reinforce that idea that we have to do something. So guilt or fear or shame or and so on, right? Yeah, don't you think there's always going to be, for whoever it is, there's always going to be. We all have those drives, and I guess guilt is probably a good general term for them. We all have those things goading us to act, saying, you've got to do something, whatever it is. You can't just sit and wait and be a burden, or be be passive, or be weak, or be ineffective, or etc., etc., etc. So I mean, it's not, there isn't an easy get out clause for what amounted to my advice there. It's always going to be uncomfortable, that liminal space, whether it's guilt about being a burden or whether it's any other narrative. There's always going to be discomfort. So then the advice that I would give to myself is a reality check, always reality check. So in that case, you think that people will find you a burden, well, check that. And you think you're imposing, well, find out. Like, say, is this an imposition? Because then a lot of the time we stack the deck against ourselves and we don't check, because we need that crucial fiction to keep us in line. I mean, just as you can question the idea that you need a job to be a productive member of a capitalist society, you can question every other incentive that you do believe in, the ones that you do believe in, that says that we're here to be virtuous, or we're here to actually live life to the full, or anything, like the idea that we're here for anything at all.
Well, that's definitely something to think about while I'm not pursuing anything immediately.
Mm-hmm. Well, you also described it in your magnetic Reiki work. Like you seek the harmony of the wave, that where the fullest enjoyment is found, to paraphrase you.
Yeah.
So that's what we're here for. And not even to seek. I would question the word seek, but you wait for the wave to take you into the maximum enjoyment. And not because life's about hedonistic experience of pleasure, but because that's where we're at maximum capacity, it seems, doesn't it, when we're actually fully engaged and enjoying experience, then we're performing at optimum capacity, and vice versa. Like the two are synonymous, I think, enjoyment and efficiency.
I guess I understand if you want to end this conversation or leave soon, but that gets back into my current associations with people. Our relationship sort of revolves around awareness of this state that keeps us from doing things that, keeps us from doing things, basically, or takes things away from us.
Right, and yet you're apolitical. Doesn't sound very apolitical.
Well, it's because even if I was working around that force, I'm still aware that it's there. It always threatens my existence, my freedom.
It always appears to.
Well, I have been to jail for possessing a plant, so...
Well, I've been to jail too, and I've been held in a Homeland Security holding cell when I was trying to get in the US for an enlightenment retreat. And I had an almost joyful experience.
I also had a joyful experience in jail. It's just troubling to me.
Why would that be troubling?
I guess in any mainstream rational view of the world, you don't want to be complacent in jail, which by definition is somewhere you don't want to be.
You don't want to be banging your head against the wall screaming motherfucking pigs either. Or you definitely don't want to be that. I didn't have any illusions. Well, I mean, besides the ones I brought with me, I didn't have any illusions about, oh, I'm in good hands now, in the sense Homeland Security. Oh, they're not what I thought. They're all lovely people, although they actually were. I just knew that I was in the hands of, fill in the blank, light of life itself. I was exactly where I needed to be, and I don't feel like that generally, so I certainly didn't back then. So the idea that I somehow needed to get thrown in jail and have all my plans thwarted, kind of in the most rudely unexpected fashion, was necessary for me to realize that I was exactly where I needed to be was pretty ironic. But that does seem to be, that's the those seem to be the conditions under which we surrender, is when we have no choice. I mean, there's still a choice in some sense, because I could have been miserable and resented it, but I had no choice about being incarcerated and not getting to go to that enlightenment retreat. That was it. So, and I chose, quote unquote, some part of me was able to surrender to it, and so that the enjoyment was in that. So I could have been in any situation. It's just that the fact that I was able to feel good in that situation magnified the capacity of me to feel good anywhere, right? Because I'm like, oh my god, I'm here, and yet somehow I'm okay with it. Therefore, the part of me that's okay with absolutely anything was being intensified by my awareness of it. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
The part of us that guides us through life and is absolutely okay no matter what is happening, because it's not restricted by our physical or our mental or our emotional experience. It's beyond all of that.
Right on. And for the sink heads, I do think it's kind of interesting that right before we started talking, I was thinking about if I were to ever meet someone I perceived as to be a prophet or someone. I've never met anyone like that. I consider myself an anarchist, agnostic, I guess, in some sense. But I was thinking about coming into contact with something I perceive to be a prophet and completely giving myself over to that.
And then what, you met a prophet?
What's that?
And then what, you bumped into a prophet on your street corner?
Oh, I mean being able to serve a true force, yeah. Being able to truly serve the will of whatever, cosmos.
So where's the synchronistic element in this? The fact that we're talking about that now, or?
Yeah, that you were just a... Oh man, it's slipping my mind. What were you just talking about?
surrendering, finding and surrendering to that part in us which is
right. Yeah, yeah.
Not of the world.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. You could say I found Christ in a Homeland Security holding cell. You could say that. It would be taking it a little too far, but
right. So yeah, just that we're talking about that now.
Right. Well, that's a relief. I thought you were going to call me a prophet from here. I've spent 10 minutes denying it.
wait. No, no.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey said when his world came tumbling.
Monkey said to man, I want your fireman. Said to monkey, I want your brain. Monkey said to man, my desire is to be like the mankind. And this was all the monkey spoke when his word came tumbling. Speaks his mind. And this was all that monkey spoke when his word came tumbling down.
La fille dans la jungle, c'est quand même bien sympa. Des lèvres l'air de bois nous posent des problèmes. Les songes sur les arbres prêtent